Welcome to Truth vs. Hollywood. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
Truth vs. Hollywood is a look at films that are based on a true story. But we don't just talk about the film, we also talk about that true story. On this podcast, we'll touch on what really happened, how that differs from the film, and why. We'll also hear the true story through interviews from experts, witnesses, and people who were involved in it. Today, we're talking about part two of Munich, the Steven Spielberg film about Israel's retaliation after Israeli athletes were killed at the Munich Olympics. When we last left off, the group of secret assassins, and also an accountant, had just pulled off a successful mission in the Arab nation of Lebanon, killing three of the terrorists they were after. But we'll soon see they won't have much more of that success, as one of the last men on their list proves very difficult to get.
So here's a section of the film that gets into the Louis of it all. Louis is the informant character played by Mathieu Amalric, and he goes to scoop up Eric Bana and tells him to just get in his car, which is, I guess, would you follow Louis to a second location? I'm not sure I would. But
well, here's the thing. If someone drives up to you and tells you to put a bag on your head, I actually think that's a good sign.
All right.
Because it means that they expect you to come back, right? Because otherwise, why put a bag on your head?
And let's be clear. Louis is a classy French gentleman, so it is not a bag. It is like an elegant black sleep mask that he asks Avner to put on his head. But so they're going to go to the Louis family compound. So the question of Louis, he's the informant. They have some questions about Louis's loyalties here. We also know that their handler, Ephraim, played by Jeffrey Rush, wants to know Louis's identity, but the team has refused to tell. This is where fact versus fiction comes into play, because as we mentioned in the last episode, there were way more people involved in these operations than Avner's team of five. And there were also many more people just giving them intelligence. It's not just one dashing Frenchman. So Louis is a composite character. Journalist Aaron Klein says there was a second secret ops unit called Caesarea that helped in a lot of the later operations, including the attack in Beirut. Here's Klein's description of how detailed the intelligence was on Beirut.
I talked with some of the people who were participating in this operation, and they said that every small detail that they asked from Caesarea to get to them, for example, how many stairs there is between the first floor to the second floor, where is the button to put on the light in the staircases, if the door of the house is open to the right or you will open it to the left. Every small detail. This is one of the operations that they had, you know, almost 100% of the details that they wanted to have. It's amazing. Combatants of Caesarea went to these apartments more than one time or twice, right? Gathering these pieces of information that was used later on in order to get to the apartments, to assassinate the three, and to go back to the cars that were taken to the shore.
Klein goes on to talk about one of the Mossad's heads of intelligence who organized these operations, a man named Mike Harari.
Mike Harari was in his 40s in the 70s, and he would comb his hair like Humphrey Bogart, and he looked like Humphrey Bogart, you know, very handsome man, full of confidence. He was at the time chain smoker, but he was very, very careful person. You know, he didn't do anything without thinking, not twice, five times before he did it. I mean, it was carried out in early January 1979, but the Mossad in Caesarea was planning to kill him much before, long before. But there was no visibility to carry it out. They were checking all kinds of options to come up with a good plan how to assassinate him. Eventually, it took them 6 years from 73 to come up with a good plan. They found out that his headquarters, his office in Beirut, he's using the same route all the time from his office back home. It took off, exploded. Ali Hassan Salameh was killed. Some of his bodyguard was killed also. And mission was completed. And he was someone who tried to prepare for everything. Very, very cautious thinking. He always said, you know, I'm not a special person. I am a person with a lot of experience. And he had a lot of experience. And I think one more thing, this Mike Harari didn't became head of Caesarea and he said, you know, I'm going to be the head of Caesarea 5 years and then I will move to be maybe the head of Mossad. When he came to be head of Caesarea, he wanted to leave significant mark as head of Caesarea.
It sounds like Mike Harari was maybe an inspiration for some of Avner's character, but the character of Mike Harari himself also appears briefly in a couple scenes with other Mossad agents, and he's played by Moshe Ivki.
So Louis and Avner drive to this wild, mafia-like family villa with a gorgeous garden and enormous family, including many well-dressed children. This is clearly some sort of family dinner. Inside, family members are hanging out like it's a holiday, and Louis brings him to see Papa, played by Michael Lonsdale, the patriarch. He's in the kitchen cutting vegetables, and he and Avner talk as they cook and chop vegetables together. Papa tells Avner his life story, and he has sympathy for Avner doing what he has to for his quote-unquote family, but Papa also says he's not thrilled about what happened in Beirut. Nonetheless, Avner is a good-paying customer, so he's going to continue business, but he ominously reminds Avner that his family still comes first. Louis and Avner have a very tense ride back to town. And John Robinson, let's just talk a little bit about this section. I mean, I think that every part of this whole sequence in the movie is meant to subvert your expectations, right? He's putting this thing on the sleeping mask on his head. You think he's going to take it off and be in this warehouse and getting tied to a chair or something, but it's actually, oh, hey, tons of kids are around. And Papa is not some, you know, guy who's holding a gun. He's wielding a butcher's knife or a chef's knife because he's cutting vegetables. This tension between Louis and Avner, like, Papa sees him, like, Avner as kind of a surrogate son almost, and Louis feels like he's kind of jealous. It's a little bit weird, but I think it kind of still works. What do you think of this whole sequence?
Yeah, I mean, they're French, but this has all the trappings of like some of the Italian gangster film tropes that we've seen, you know, like the cooking, the crime family boss who cooks, like that's classic, right?
Yes.
And then, you know, we talked about whether or not there's some things that are a little on the nose in this film. And I think the whole, like, when they're handling the meat and he's like, you've got butcher's hands like me, you know what I mean? Sort of like just sort of like, you're a killer, Avner, and Avner's like, no, I'm a poet. Anyway, so it's a little on the nose, but I love this character. Like, Michael Lonsdale's performance is great, and I love
he has a great look to him.
Yeah,
you know? he looks very imposing, but also gentle.
Yeah, and so. I really love the capper, which is like you could have been a son of mine, right? So that's a dig at Louis. Like, you are more like a son that I would want than my son. And then he digs at Avner and he's like, but you're not my son. And don't forget that you're not family. You know what I mean? And it's just like,
it's a little bit of a stretch because I don't think like Avner and Papa have spoken enough for Papa to really make that conclusion, in my opinion. But whatever. And also, I'm feeling bad for Louis, who, as we've discussed, is a composite character. I'm like, oh, poor composite character, you know, that he's getting the shaft from his dad here.
Well, it feels more like that was about him taking a dig at Louis, which I think is something, you know, you and I are fans of the HBO series Succession. Like, this feels like something that would happen in that family, you know what I mean? Where it's like raining a favor down on another person just to sort of mess with your kid's head a bit. And that's sort of what it feels like is going on here. And it kind of, you know, it seems like it works on Louis. It gets under his skin a bit. And, it increases the tension in his relationship with Avner.
Taking a step back, I think probably the plot function of this character, the thematic function of this character, I think would be to depict the idea that there are many different ideas of family and what family's responsibility, like what your responsibilities to your family are, that can be conceived in many different ways. I would say that this, you know, Papa's family probably has they're amoral in different ways than the other parties we see in the movie, right? It seems like they have no issue selling out certain characters, putting characters in harm's way. Like, they know that they're giving people information that will lead to the people's death, right? But they're okay with it. And so it's kind of interesting, like, what their mysterious level of morals are.
And I think, you know, we're not supposed to know where we stand with Papa, just as Avner does not know where it feels weird calling him Papa, but like we're not supposed to know where Avner stands with him. And that, you know, adds tension later in the film when they're wondering if Louis is giving them bad information or intentionally setting them up or, you know, sending assassins after them. You know, they don't know, they can't trust. And so I think going to the family compound really underlines that, rather than, you know, I think you get it more than you would if you just got it from interactions with Louis himself, if that makes sense.
Indeed, indeed. So Louis drops Avner off in town and says the name Ali Hassan Salame, who orchestrated the Munich tragedy. We've heard the name once before, but now he's being set up as kind of, you know, in a conventional movie, we'd call him the big boss character. Here's journalist Dan Raviv to talk about Salame.
Salame was a very dangerous combination. He liked fast cars, blonde women. He even married a Miss Universe, a woman from Lebanon. But he also was cautious, cruel, and aggressive. On the other hand, he was clever and innovative. He thought of ways of attacking the Israelis that they hadn't considered.
Anki Spitzer, widow of Munich athlete Andre Spitzer, tells us a little bit more.
Ali Hassan Salame was called the Red Prince because he came from this very well-known and rich family. So he was called the prince, and he was a playboy. He was, you know, he liked to go out, and he was very well spoken, and he looked good and everything. And he was called the Red Prince because he had leftish sympathies, you know, political sympathies, which was not exactly the same as other leaders of the Palestinian authorities or organizations, you know. So he was a very special guy, being in nightclubs and going around and women and very difficult to catch.
So before they go after Salome, they track down Zaid Mutasi, who is lying low in Athens. Louis sets him up in a safe house, and the place looks like garbage. My roommate jokes as we were watching it, it looks like what you can afford to live in the Bay Area. Anyway, it has almost no furniture. They're sleeping on the floor. Robert, the explosive expert played by Matthew Kesevitz, is trying to build a bomb, but he says that Louis gave them pretty old explosives. As we talked about in the last episode, we don't know if Robert is just covering for his own like bad bomb making skills or if Louis is actually giving them bad materials. But we have further reason to distrust Louis with what happens next, because we hear later at night, everyone's on their mattresses, comfy and cozy on their thin mattresses with their guns right next to them. And they hear a noise and they're up like a shot and ready to sort of draw their guns on who comes in. It turns out that Louis has also set up the safe house for the PLO, which is a choice that Louis made here. Avner calms everyone down by claiming they're other militant activist groups, and they all agree to share the safe house. So over the course of the night, the group, you know, squabble and bond. They've got Al Green on the radio. And then one of the PLO fighters, Ale, played by Omar Metwali, has a long conversation with Avner about what Palestine means to him. And Avner seems sympathetic. And this is one of my favorite scenes of the film. Dave, do you want to talk about it a little bit here?
Well, it's one of several lengthy conversations that occurs about what it means to have a home. And as we discussed in the first episode about this film, the movie is criticized for equating these Israeli activities as depicted with what the Palestinian terrorists do. I think this is one of the scenes that led to that, because you really get the feeling like these two characters are two sides of the same coin from this scene. That's kind of my perception of it. What do you think?
Yeah, it's not just a perception. Like some of the things that Ale says here in the stairwell, you hear again from like Avner's mother later in the film. She says like, no matter how long it takes, like all, like some of the wording is just echoed later in the film by some of the Israeli characters. And so, I mean, I think once again, what Spielberg is going for here is to not, you know, condone Palestinian terrorist behavior at all, obviously, but to say at the root of this, aren't these two...
Doesn't it come from a human desire?
Yeah, right? And aren't these two groups that fundamentally want the same thing, with different circumstances, obviously, but like home. They both are fighting over the same territory and want to call it home. That's just true. That's true without taking a side. You can just say that's true, right? So I really like this scene a lot, and I know this is an extremely complicated political question, but I think when you get down to a fundamental human level, I think this is a really, really tremendously powerful scene, especially with what happens to Ale later. So
I also think it's a great touch that they bond over Al Green, which, you know, this is an American movie, right? It's made by an American, and there is just something beautiful about the fact that American culture can be a unifying point for people on many different sides of whatever issue. But anyway, they have to put their similarities and differences aside as these characters need to proceed with the assassination. Unfortunately, the bomb doesn't work as planned again, and the accountant Hans, played by Hans Zischler, goes back inside to see what's going on. He tosses a grenade in the room, shuts the door, it detonates, blows the door off, but Hans is somehow okay. Avner kills the bodyguard, but Ali sees him and realizes that he's Mossad or Mossad connected, and they have no choice but to kill Ali as well. In the car, they've also kidnapped the gentleman who works at the hotel, who keeps chatting nervously in Greek. Robert is being berated for making bad bombs, and we finally get the revelation that he's trained to dismantle bombs, not to build them. So they leave the guy on the side of the road with some money, and they drive away.
Omner has his eye on the big prize, which is Salome, right? And something that Louis tells him is repeatedly is, no, it's impossible. You can't get to him. He's too protected. And finally, he says that the reason is that Salome has done some work for the CIA. Basically, according to the film, Salome has promised the CIA that they will not carry out any acts of terrorism on the U.S. if the CIA protects Salome. But nonetheless, the team go to London to try to track this target down. We see an attempted assassination plot with our five guys and Salome in the street. It's raining because it's London. Of course it's raining. And they get foiled by a group of Americans on the street. The implication is that the men were CIA and were sabotaging this plot. It's never confirmed, but they go from like acting drunk to not. You know, they flip off
the
guys.
They give them the finger.
Yeah, as they drive past. Like it seems.
I think it's CIA.
It's probably CIA. So anyway, our heroes here, if you want to call them that, are very thrown off, and they go back to their London hotel.
At the hotel bar, a woman is very obviously checking out Avner. They flirt for a few minutes, and then he leaves to go to bed. On the way upstairs, he sees Carl and warns him half-jokingly that there is a honey trap at the bar. Avner also calls his wife in Brooklyn and decides to go out there when he's finished with his mission. The toll of his work seems to finally be weighing on him. We see flashbacks of the Munich massacre and of the athletes that are put on the bus to go to the airport blindfolded.
This is another like extremely powerful scene where Avner is like breaks down into tears at hearing his daughter's voice on the phone, right? Like it's just, you know, like trying to hold it back, but just sort of just like cracking open. If you want to talk about like Bana being very stoic, Eric Bana's performance being very stoic, as we did in the last episode throughout the film, like this is one of the most emotional moments for him of the film is just hearing his daughter's voice on the phone. So
yeah, really effective.
Yeah. So when he's back in the hotel hallway, Avner recognizes this woman's perfume, and at first he thinks that Carl is like, you know, hooking up with this woman, but then he notices that the door is slightly ajar, and when he goes into the room, he discovers that Carl has been assassinated. And Avner, who's just like crying openly on the phone, screams into a pillow. It's just like this is a real cracking point for this character. And Louis and Papa decide to give up the information for free this time because they're really feeling for Avner. Maybe, but it's also like, did they give up Carl? Like, there's a lot of questions. We don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, they basically reveal that this is a Dutch assassin. Her name's Jeanette. And they tell them where she is. And even though this is not their mission, the four remaining Israeli operatives decide to avenge this death. And then Robert, at the last minute, like sort of before they get on the train, Robert's like, I can't do it. I need a break. So
Steve, Avner, and Hans ride bikes to a houseboat in the Netherlands where the assassin lives. As Hollywood as the story sounds and feels like, apparently this really happened. The only difference was that in real life, the assassin shared a boat with another woman and they had to wait around all day for her to leave. But in the film, she's immediately home by herself. The operatives break in wielding these one-time use guns that they kept on their bikes. They shoot her a couple times and her robe opens. Avner moves to close it, but Han says to leave it. Do we want to talk about the scene, Joanna?
Yeah. This scene is interesting because, like, okay, so obviously this is a woman who uses her body as part of her, you know, it's part of her skill set. And, like, that's a very real thing that happens in the world. It's an interesting use of nudity that feels initially gratuitous. And then later, as we see, it take its toll on Hans, who first insists that they keep her robe open after they've shot and killed her, and then later regrets that choice. Then the nudity at least feels like it has some thematic plot importance, even if it's just to sort of further the emotional decay of a male character. But I don't know. What do you think of this sequence?
Yeah, I mean, it's really demeaning the way they leave her in that state. And while we've already talked a little bit about the limited role of women in this movie, and it's kind of a bummer that one of the only few female speaking roles is one that, like, gets humiliated in this way, I do appreciate that the movie takes time to pause and reflect on that humiliation as being something that's that these characters find to be unfortunate. Like, the character Hans is, like, upset at himself, right, that he allowed this to happen. Like, he got too into the moment. These characters are reflecting on the act of killing, right? And there's this chilling conversation that happens afterwards where they're cooking dinner and eating already, where Avner says something along the lines of that he one day he's going to wake up and kill someone and he's not even going to feel anything, right?
Right.
And Hans is distressed at the fact that he left the woman in this way. Like, he's like, I shouldn't have done that. This mission is transforming these characters, and the movie shows that with how humiliated this woman is, and it shows that in the fact that they take a moment to reflect on the fact that they did it. And so I appreciate that it at least has, like, a thematic purpose that they did it this way. As with most of the killings in this movie, it is, like, a really upsetting death. And they're using these guns that I think are, like, meant to look like parts of bikes or, like a bike pump or something like that.
Yeah.
I think my guess is, like, it's easier to smuggle those in than to smuggle actual weapons into wherever they were going in the Netherlands.
Right, but, and they have, like, an innate silencer sort of aspect to them, right?
Yeah.
They're almost like, you know, darts is what they almost, like, act like. Yeah.
When they shoot her and then she kind of knows that she's dead and she has this, like, she's staring into the middle distance, it's chilling. It's, like, a really chilling scene, I think.
What's interesting is, you know, we've talked about the use of women in this film. What you do get by having an all-male team, these five operatives, is the fact that they have this sort of, like, chivalrous code where they're trying to never hurt women or children, right? They're going after male targets and they're constantly protective of women and children. And so, as, like, slightly patronizing as that might be, because there are definitely, like, women who are involved in terrorist plots and stuff like that, it does make the line that they cross here a little clearer, at least to their sort of like chivalric notions. And so the fact that they've been so protective of these various things, and then trying to have some decorum in the way in which they're conducting these murders across Europe. And the fact that this particular thing, which is off mission for them, is an act of pure personal revenge for them. The operation as a whole is called Wrath of God, but this is, like, a very, you know, this time it's personal because, like, it was their friend who got, right? And how ugly that kind of emotional, personal revenge is. And you see this woman just, like, you know, exposed and bare and, like, not even given the dignity of being covered in death by Hans, who's a character who hasn't been, like, a brutal character throughout the film at all. It's just sort of like he's overwhelmed by his feelings about what happened to Carl. And Robert doesn't even have the taste to do it in the first place. You know what I mean? Like, that's what this act is for them. It's a real crossing of a line.
Yeah, indeed. So one by one, we see the assassins become the assassinated. Hans is found on a bench with a knife in his chest, and Robert's house explodes. And I think there's some question as to whether that's his fault. Do you have a conclusion on that? I think he was killed. But I think the movie makes it a little bit ambiguous.
It's a little ambiguous. I think he's assassinated based on how careful he is with all of the things that he's sort of like packing away. I think we're supposed to see like how careful he's being. And so the likelihood of him just accidentally blowing himself up feels not correct. But we haven't yet talked about, I think, I just really want to quickly point out that like this idea that he's a toy maker and he has all these little like cunning devices. But this idea that like, bombs are not toys. Like, that's not a one-to-one translation. So.
Yeah, yeah. So with the team disintegrating, Steve and Avner decide on one last hit, and then maybe they go home. Salome is throwing a party in Spain, and Avner and Steve sneak through the garden, dressed in black head to toe, intending to hit him with a sniper rifle through the window. There are only two of them, which feels like pretty rough in terms of having a lot of backup for your mission. But of course, Salome has guards, and they can't get that close that easily. They're shot at and have to run away. It seems like they're just really not into this anymore. I do also want to point out that they accidentally killed one of the guards who looks very young, right? And the movie takes a moment to pause on this, like Eric Bana's look of horror at this, because I think to this point, it's one of very few civilians or collateral damage that have resulted from their mission. And so I do think he still is able to be moved by killing. And in this case, he was done so by a character he killed who wasn't the intended target.
So in the film, that spells the end of the Operation Wrath of God. But exactly that sort of scenario that you're talking about that happens in Spain here in the movie is somewhat based on a real life event that happened in the Norwegian city of Lillehammer. Where there were much more than two people involved. Journalists Aron Heller, Aaron Klein, and Dan Raviv tell the story. First, we'll hear from Heller.
Lillehammer, city in Norway, which probably if you ask most people in the world, they'd say, oh, that's where the 1994 Winter Olympics were, or where there's this HBO show, right, that they called Lillehammer. In Israel, if you say Lillehammer, the immediate assumption is different. That's where the fiasco happened. That's where it went wrong.
Aaron Klein also says that one of their operatives was a Danish-born volunteer.
She was taken, and she was very, you know, she was a rookie, as you say. And he sent them after Ali Hassan Salim. They started to go to the north, towards the Scandinavian states. And so he gathered this lady who knew the language, she knew Norwegian, and another guy of his people that knew he was Danish, so he knew also he could understand what's going on, because he need people to read signs, you know, to be able to communicate with the rental agency, and to be able to come up with to read a sign on the door, what's the name of the family.
Dan Raviv and Aron Heller have a bit more information.
The Mossad spotters weren't sure it was Salome. They had photographs, but there really weren't excellent photographs of this elusive red prince. He appeared to be married to a local woman, a pregnant Norwegian. As the couple emerged from the movie theater, the Mossad spotters were watching and felt that a moment of vulnerability was approaching. The spotters called in the assassins. Two Mossad men with guns who did not take the time to question their target. They simply opened fire and pumped 12 bullets into him. They didn't do anything or say anything to the man's wife. The two attackers simply fled.
Israel thought they had Ali Hassan Salama. They thought he was the guy. They took him out, shot him, killed him. And then afterwards it finds out it wasn't exactly the guy they were looking for. It was some poor Moroccan waiter named Ahmad Bouchiki.
All of this exposed in the Norwegian courts, the European and world press, Prime Minister Golda Meir was deeply upset. Obviously, operational security had been violated, but beyond that, the image of Israel, murdering people in foreign countries, murdering the wrong man, Meir told the Mossad to stop the assassinations.
Back to the film. In Israel, some young IDF soldiers pick up a depressed and disillusioned Avner from the airport. They're not supposed to know who he is, but they do. And like 19-year-olds, they think he's the coolest person in the world. The film takes a turn and is now a solemn reflection on the emptiness of vengeance and the thanklessness of being a black ops agent. A general passes on information to Avner from Golda Meir, but she can't tell him herself because she doesn't officially know him. Ephraim and Avner sit down for a debrief, and he sets up this enormous tape recorder. He says they did a good job, and everything was by the book, except they shouldn't have killed the assassin on the houseboat. He also says that Louis sold information on them to the PLO, so Ephraim demands information about Louis, and once again, Avner refuses to give up his informant, and Ephraim gets really mad about it.
There's this really interesting section where Avner reconnects with his mother, and they talk a lot about, once again, that idea of home and what Israel means to her. She's a Holocaust survivor, and what the notion of Israel means to the Jewish people. But Avner decides to not stay in Israel. He wants nothing to do with any of it after what he's done, and he wants to move. He moves to Brooklyn to be with his wife and his daughter. But, you know, a lot has happened in this movie. Avner is not just immediately going to go home and be happy about it. So, you know, he has no idea who he is without Mossad. He can't do simple things like walk through Brooklyn with his daughter. He sees a car that looks like it's following him, and then it rolls down the window only to drop a cigarette, but he thinks someone's after him. I don't fully blame him, but he calls Louis' father and asks him what's going on. Is this, you know, is this Louis' family? What's happening here? And Papa responds that, like, he promises that no harm would come from him, from Papa. Dave, do you believe Papa in this moment?
You know, here's my reaction when Papa said the thing he said. He says, like, no harm will come to you because of me or from my family. And I thought he was wording that very carefully. I guess that's how I thought it was. It's like, I mean, I might give information to someone about you that them, you know, like, that's what I thought. He was like leaving himself a lot of wiggle room with that statement, was my interpretation.
No one in my family will pull the trigger, is what I'm saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. This idea of home, returning home, I think is really interesting. We've talked about Israel as like a home, a larger home, you know, or Palestine is a home for people. But this idea of like the physical home, like Avner is like often outside this, you know, model kitchen store. That's how where he has conversations with Louis, like looking at this kitchen, which is such this like domestic, like longing for home sort of thing. And I think right before the Salome assassination, Louis says something like, if you do this one, like surely they'll send you home, right? You know, so this idea of like home, returning to it, but obviously like you can't go home again is a phrase for a reason. And you know, Spielberg has, I think, covered this a bit before with some of his war films. There's no coming back from something like this. And so Avner is in Brooklyn. He's in the bosom of a loving family, but he is like, you know, emotionally, morally shattered. And he's decided that the threat to his family must be coming from Mossad. So he goes to the Israeli consulate and, you know, threatens everyone and gets thrown out, basically. Eventually, Ephraim comes, you know, to bring Avner back to Israel. And, you know, Avner says, come to dinner, break bread. Ephraim declines. And, you know, we like these two are never going to be reconciled in any sort of way. Avner is dealing with a lot of trauma. And the last shot of the film is centered on like a digitally included twin towers in the New York City skyline. We're on, you know, we're on the other side of the river and the camera is roaming around. And I don't know about you, Dave, but like I remembered that the twin towers were in this film, but I kept like anxiously waiting for the camera to find them. And they're just sort of like there. It's not like an anvil at the end of the film, but it is the last shot of the film. The towers are there, in the skyline.
It's pretty subtle. Like they're in the background. They're not like, it's not like right at, they didn't meet at the base of the twin towers or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think the function of it, right, is twofold. Number one, it's, to indicate by the way, like the cycle of violence continues after this film,
right?
After the events of this film, right? It's not just because they killed most of the guys. It's not like the cycle of violence is over, that it keeps going. It keeps roiling people. It keeps exacting the cost that you've witnessed many times over. And number two, I think that Spielberg is interrogating the role of the United States in a lot of this violence, right? Like it's obviously the fact that the Twin Towers are in the United States and our retaliation for what happened on September 11th. Like he's asking about, like with that final shot, he's asking about the United States and its soul as well, not just Avner, which, you know, that can seem very remote. The Munich Olympics can seem very remote when you're watching something like this. Like, they took place in another country, and another country sent assassins to take out the guys that were responsible for it. And the final shot says, actually, like, it's a lot closer than you think. And the questions that the movie raises, I think Spielberg wants us to think about as the United States as well.
Absolutely. So we should talk about that scene that happens right before the Ephraim and Avner connection, which is, like, I think the most famous scene from Munich, which is Avner and Daphne, like, reunited in bed. And, you know, this, we've already seen them have sex, like, at the beginning of the film. It's very tender. She's 7 months pregnant. He's being very tender with her. So, like, this is our comparison, right? And what we see now, like, Eric, I remember when I saw this, the film, the first time, like, being so uncomfortable with it that I just, like, made fun of it. And now I'm kind of all in on the film, and I find it extremely moving and profound, this sort of haunted, animalistic, violent, you know, thing that Avner has become, and Daphne, like, trying to reach him, and sort of him not really even being there. And the use of the machine gun fire lighting up Banna's face, I think it's brilliant. So I don't know what you think of the ending, of that part of the ending.
Well, I am all in on the movie as well, but I still think the scene is a little bit laughable, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Like, it feels kind of silly to me. I understand what the scene is trying to say.
Right.
Right? Which is that, basically, this character has been irrevocably changed by what he's been through. And these things that he's done, all the lives that he's killed, that has made him into a different person, and that the specter of that is going to intrude on his personal life forever.
Right.
And so I get what he's trying to say, but I just think that juxtaposing this, like, extremely horrifying act of violence, like, the thing that sticks with me is not, obviously I remember the sex scene, but the thing that sticks with me is, like, when the Palestinian people have, like, they basically understand, like, the jig is up, everyone's dying, and one of the characters kind of looks at this plane, this helicopter full of Israeli Olympians, and, you know, there's this look on their face of, like, defeat, of, like, basically, like, please don't kill us, and the character makes a decision to kill them all, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just like, he could have easily not killed them, he could have understood, like, hey, this is over, but, like, that in that moment he chose vengeance because, like, that's what he was configured to do, by a variety of circumstances and psychologies. That's the thing that haunts me, of like, how easy it is in our modern society of, like, making the decision between, you know, killing someone and not killing someone, and how easy it is for people to choose the path of most violence. That haunts me. But then juxtaposing it with a sex scene, it just does feel a little bit silly to me. It feels a little bit over the top, and I feel like there are other ways of conveying that weren't, like, a slow motion sex scene of, you know, muzzle flashes on Eric Bana's face as he's climaxing. But that's me. And if it works for you, it works for many people. You know, like, I think there was a lot of conversation about this sex scene when the movie first came out.
Uh-huh.
And I think people had different reactions to it. So my reaction is, it still doesn't quite work for me, but I appreciate what it's trying to do.
You're right.
So now, it wouldn't be a Truth versus Hollywood film without the Where Are They Now kind of cards that we get at the end. We only get one in this movie, which is an update on the rest of the assassination attempts. We learn that 9 of the listed 11 men were killed, including Salome. It took another few years, but Mossad and Caesarea managed to track him down. Here's journalist Aaron Klein to tell what happened.
The assassination of Ali Hassan Salome was carried out in early January 1979, but the Mossad and Caesarea was planning to kill him much before, long before. But there was no visibility to carry it out. They were checking all kinds of options to come up with a good plan how to assassinate him. Eventually, it took them 6 years from 73 to come up with a good plan. They found out that his headquarters, his office in Beirut, he's using the same route all the time from his office back home. So they said, let's put a bomb in a car along this route and we'll explode it with the remote control when he will pass. He had bodyguards, he had, you know, a few cars, but they knew in which one he's using. You know, it's always the fancy one. And this was the plan. So they decided, according to what happened, they're gonna send a woman combatant to be in the sitting on the balcony and to push the button of this remote control in order to assassinate Ali Hassan Salama. It's a big operation that is made of a lot of small operations that eventually led to the situation that on this morning of early January 1979, the convoy of Ali Hassan Salameh was passing this this corner. The car was waiting for him. This car bomb was waiting for him. This the women combatant was sitting in the balcony waiting for him. She pushed the button. It took off, exploded. Ali Hassan Salameh was killed. Some of his bodyguard was killed also, and mission was completed.
Why weren't we given the closure of this? You know, is a question we might ask. Why didn't we see Salameh die? A couple things, like Salameh is never really a figure, a character unto himself, right? Which you could make a movie with him as more of a character. They called him the Red Prince, which is like an incredible, like he masterminded a lot of terror. And like, this is a very high placed figure responsible for a lot of violent activity. But in the function of this movie, he's really just a target. He's the prize. And the fact that we never see, you know, Banna and his team get that prize, I think underscores that idea of the futility of this operation. The idea that, like, no matter who we kill, it will just be replaced by someone else, maybe someone else more brutal than the person that we took out. We don't even know that these guys were actually connected to the Munich Olympics in the first place. So the fact that they never get their prize, if you want to call it that way, I think matters thematically to the film. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Joanna. I think one of the many things this movie's trying to say is that the cycle of violence is never over. And so for them to just kind of tie that up, and like, if the movie ended with the killing of Salameh, you'd be like, oh, well, I guess that problem has been solved in some way, you know. But like, that's the opposite of what this movie's trying to say. So I think there's a reason it doesn't show Salameh being killed. It's trying to leave you with a sense of like incompletion, because that's what the cycle of violence as depicted in the movie does to people. It leaves them feeling like this will never be over. So
Another interesting fallout from the Munich massacre was that Germany changed their laws about the army being allowed to, you know, be involved in combat on German soil. It took a while, though. Here's Munich survivor Yehuda Weinstein on the subject.
2 years ago, they changed the rules, which enables the German army to act on German soil. That's only 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. So I didn't have reflection right after that. But later on, I understood how terribly wrong everything was done.
That's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Truth vs. Hollywood. Thank you so much for tuning in. The next movie we'll be discussing is American Gangster. What's something that the movie changed from real life? The fact that Frank Lucas, apparently not as charismatic as Denzel Washington. That
what?
Could be said for like 99.9% of the world's population. So, but we'll get into more of the details next week. Truth vs. Hollywood is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production. It's hosted by me, David Chen.
And me, Joanna Robinson.
It's produced by Audio Boom's Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, Blair Payton, and Lauren Vogel, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights, with help from James Tyndale. I have a show where I interview artists, filmmakers, and other cool people. You can find that at culturallyrelevantshow.com or search for Culturally Relevant in any of your podcast apps. You can also find me on YouTube making videos about movies at youtube.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y.
I am, believe it or not, rewatching the television show Lost one episode at a time, so you can hear us cover that and get great interviews from people who worked on the show at thestormpodcast.com. It's called The Storm. Also, I will be watching some fun TV shows over on Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast.
Until next time, feel free to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows, and leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it. It would help this podcast to stand out amidst the crowd. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Truth vs. Hollywood.